Good morning, everyone. Am I audible?
Yeah.
Good morning, everyone. We welcome you all to the second day of the SDG4 Seminar 2022. Yesterday, we had different workshops and lectures on the various perspectives of education for emergency. Continuing on the same, our keynote speaker for today from India will share about what is dialogue, the nature of dialogue, and how dialogue can become central to education in all its aspects for us educators. I'm very happy to invite my teacher, Shashidhar Jagdishan, fondly called by everyone as Shash or Shashi, who will give us more insights on this topic from his experience as a teacher. Shashidhar has been working at Center for Learning, a teacher-run school for the last 27 years. The school is based on the educational philosophy of the late Jiddu Krishnamurti. Shashidhar has a PhD in mathematics from Syracuse University and has taught mathematics to students from middle school to undergraduate level. Once again, a warm welcome on behalf of the entire SDG4 team and audience. We look forward to hearing you. Over to you, Shash.
Good morning, everybody. Thank you, Heidi, and thank you, Abita, for giving me this chance to share notions on dialogue and the philosophy of our school. I'll begin by sharing screen.
Yeah. Yeah, it's visible. Yeah.
Yeah. So the search for shared meaning is as old as humanity itself. Anthropologists talk about the circle of discourse that Native American tribes participated in. And perhaps to this day, many small tribal communities continue to engage in such dialogue. Key elements of such dialogue are that they are non-hierarchical, all participants are respected, and listening and speaking are equally important. One of the most important texts that expound Advaita Vedanta philosophy, a non-dualistic philosophy from India, are the Upanishads. The root meaning of this Sanskrit word is to sit near. The idea being that the teacher and the student would sit together and go into fundamental questions about life and living. All of us are, of course, familiar with the Socratic dialogue and the intent of reaching a state of aporia or puzzlement, where all previously held assumptions are shown to be either wrong or inadequate. This state of puzzlement or not knowing would then lead to understanding. In this presentation, I will be drawing from my experience as a teacher at CFL, where we as a group have been exploring the role of dialogue in education and how best to translate our understanding of the philosophy that animates the school into our daily life and into the curriculum of the school. While many elements of what I mentioned earlier inform our dialogue, at the outset itself, I'd like to acknowledge that our notions of dialogue have been greatly influenced by the physicist David Bohm, and the philosophy of the school by the teachings of the philosopher J. Krishnamurti. In fact, they both have had fascinating dialogues which have been published as books and are now easily available on YouTube. As and when appropriate, I will refer to their work. The title of this talk comes from the following notion of dialogue that David Bohm had. The word dialogue derives from two roots, dia, which means through, and logos, which means the word, or more particularly, the meaning of the word. The image it gives is a river of meaning flowing around and through the participants. Any number of people can engage in dialogue. One can even have a dialogue with oneself. In this presentation, I would like to explore how the flow of meaning can happen in the classroom, in creating a community of learners, and most importantly, in learning about ourselves. At CFL, interaction with students take place in a variety of ways, formal and informal. I'd like to begin to share how dialogue plays a role in formal learning places, and will focus on two aspects of learning for which I feel dialogue is relevant: understanding content and the well-being of the learner. The learning session often begins with the teacher asking a question or making a brief presentation, following which there's a free flow of conversation among all of us. Questioning is constantly encouraged, and the role of the teacher as an authority figure is kept light. Meaning is gradually built as this dialogue goes on, with the teacher bringing in knowledge and skill interwoven with the student's thinking process. All this to enable a flow of meaning among the participants. Needless to say, while flow of meaning is a key to our educational philosophy, we use many other pedagogical tools like observation, experimental work, hands-on learning, project-based work, drill, and continuous assessment to make sure that the understanding translates into mastery and retention of knowledge. Strangely, while understanding is the key to the acquisition, transfer, and creation of knowledge, it's a bit of a mystery how exactly insight or the aha moment actually takes place. So it might be worthwhile asking if there's something that can be done to facilitate this. I would like to suggest there are some essential ingredients to the dialogue that make understanding possible. First and foremost, the relationship between the teacher and student is based on affection and mutual respect. I feel it's absolutely necessary that we create an atmosphere of care in the classroom. This cannot happen when we use traditional motivators like fear, competition, reward, and punishment. Not only do they prevent learning, they end up brutalizing the learner. There has to be an atmosphere of listening. I will quote Krishnamurti on this. I do not know if you have ever examined how you listen. It doesn't matter to what, whether to a bird, to the wind in the leaves, to the rushing waters, or how you listen to a dialogue with yourself, to your conversation in various relationships with your intimate friends, your wife or husband. If we try to listen, we find it extraordinarily difficult because we are always projecting our opinions and ideas, our prejudices, our background, our inclinations, our impulses. When they dominate, we hardly listen to what is being said. In that state, there is no value at all. One listens and therefore learns only in a state of attention, a state of silence in which this whole background is in abeyance, is quiet, then it seems to me it is possible to communicate. There is attention. I'd like to say, while the flow of meaning is very key, more importantly for us is these notions of listening and attention, which inform all aspects of our education and the basis of the whole school. Again, to quote Krishnamurti, when your teacher tells you to pay attention in class, what does he mean? He means that you must not look out of the window, that you must withdraw your attention from everything else and concentrate wholly on what you're supposed to be studying. Or When you're absorbed in a novel, your whole mind is so concentrated on it that for a moment, you have lost interest in everything else. This is another form of attention. So in the ordinary sense, paying attention is a narrowing down process, is it not? But I think there's a different kind of attention, a state of mind which is not exclusive, which does not shut out anything. And because there is no resistance, the mind is capable of much greater attention. I'm sure many of you have taught and have had sessions where this flow of meaning has taken place. There's a great sense of satisfaction when this happens. Now, let us turn our attention to the issue of the well-being of the learner. Heidi was sharing with us that it's a key ingredient of primary education in Finland. It would be nice to learn about more about the notion of well-being that is shared among Finnish teachers. I will share our understanding of well-being, actually more about what causes ill-being. Curiously, as the learning process is taking place, simultaneously, there's the creation of a learner. I understand that a key aspect of successful learning is the idea of metacognition. That is an awareness of the very process of learning. I too feel this is absolutely necessary. However, I'm suggesting something slightly different. What I mean is that each one of us feels that there's a learner who is separate from the learning and to whom learning is happening. That is, we are adding layers of information to our sense of self. In a school context, the learner is filled with insecurities, comparisons, inadequacies, or pride, arrogance. These happen in a benign school such as CFL, or indeed most of the schools in Finland. Being child friendly is not enough to avert all these self-related knots. This concern of ours is not limited to the classroom. We all have a visceral sense of being an individual self to whom life is happening. This self is always separating itself from everything, the world, nature, and even its very own emotions and thoughts. By its very nature, then, the self is divisive, and it's not a big leap to see that when there is division, there's bound to be alienation and conflict. We feel as long as we live life in this manner, there can be no well-being for either the individual or the collective. The one thread of dialogue is to regularly question the reality of the learner. Is there really a learner separate from learning, or is this an illusion? Over the course of this presentation, I will keep revisiting this theme of the divisive self. Moving to creating a learning community, interacting with students in formal learning spaces is only a small part of what we do at CFL. We are a semi-residential community, and this places several demands on all members of the community. We need to share, for example, the philosophy of the school with parents and students. We need to take care of our campus, be responsible for all creatures that we share life with, make sure there's food on the table, care for our bodies and minds intelligently, deal with human interactions with all their complexities and all the many little things that make up our daily life. A further challenge we've taken upon ourselves is that we can do this, we have to do this without using the standard tools that humans have used to manage societies: fear, comparison, reward, and punishment. We would like to work together in a cooperative manner, being sensitive to each other. After all, a school is a microcosm of society, and we feel what we do at CFL should reflect the society we wish to create and live in. How does one go about doing this? I feel the key to this is the ability to see together. This applies from the mundane chores of daily life to dealing with misdemeanors that could be quite harmful. I'd like to say that seeing together is different from common notions that drive cooperation, like agreeing to disagree, one person, one vote, tolerance to diverse view, and reaching a consensus. All of these somehow retain our individual sense of self, which I pointed out earlier is fundamentally divisive. The act of seeing together seems to happen when we put aside self-interest, our particular preferences, opinions, beliefs, and conclusions. Once we see something together, then we can act from a sense of shared meaning, and cooperation then becomes effortless. I'd like to spend a few minutes on the idea of shared meaning. I would like to distinguish it from myths, beliefs, and ideologies. Humans have had this incredible capacity to come together over ideas, not just about how to live, but also ideas about what lies beyond death. This coming together is often limited and invariably collapses once the ideas lose their valence. On the other hand, if there's a seeing together that comes with common insight, something not based on ideas and concepts, it will allow us to distinguish the real from the false. It has an inbuilt feature of self-correction. For us, dialogue is the essential tool to think and see together in a questioning and gently skeptical way. In dialogue, we can discover the need to completely set aside our personal conditioning, to die to our own beliefs and formulated experiences, making it possible to see in that unique mirror of relationship the whole truth of what is. Then, if we share in the same spirit of inquiry, intensity, and affection, we may actually find ourselves thinking together, not necessarily agreeing or disagreeing, but seeing, understanding, and thereby sharing as one the same reality. The last section I'd like to go into learning about oneself, which is the most important part of our philosophy. Perhaps at the cost of repeating myself, I'd like to say the starting point of CFL's educational philosophy is that society at large is the result of the relationship among its members. If the members function from a deep sense of division and are driven constantly by the urge for self-protection, then the society we create will reflect this. So we have to begin with ourselves and see if it's possible to live differently. This demands a great humility, vulnerability, and an alertness to our conditioning and its push towards self-centeredness. I'd like to translate it to what happens at CFL, for example. So as Abhita said, CFL is a teacher-run school. It has a flat structure and there's no hierarchy among its teachers. We see dialogue as essential in two ways. If the teacher body is to be truly non-hierarchical, then it's extremely important that there's a flow of meaning among the teachers. Equally important, dialogue is also a space to share our observation about the nature of our conditioning, for us to confront the common consciousness that we share and come upon an intelligence that will inform our actions. In exploring the limitations of our conditioning, perhaps together we'll be able to create a new culture spontaneously and effortlessly in which we can live with sensitivity, insight, and love. Thank you. I'll stop sharing now.
We are clapping. Continue clapping. Now it's unmuted.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for your very insightful and refreshing talk. It was a very nice talk to start our second day of the seminar. Now we would like to open the floor for the audience to reflect on, ask questions, any comments. Let me see the chat. I have had a if the technique is working, then I am not working. Where's the chat now? Yeah. I have had a privilege to visit the CFL, the school. It's amazing place in the middle of a, it's not like mountains, but hilly area, surrounded by beautiful nature. I think where the meaning of life becomes quite essential because you are so closely connected to the nature. It was very impressive the way how some of the food that is eaten and cooked at school is grown there. How the students, they wake up in the morning and they take care of the facilities. So they have divided duties every morning to start the day. They have amazing library and library system that the students maintain. It's really impressive place. I think it's a place that kind of like you really feel the heart of the education when you visit that school. Anything that any there's okay there's a
yeah I had a question.
Great, Tara.
No one else wants to ask one. Shashi, can you hear me?
Yes.
Thank you very much for your presentation. I found it very interesting and it resonated with many of the discussions I think we've already had in different workshops yesterday. I wanted to ask you, what would you say to educators who disagree, who say that you do need a hierarchical structure, that this is just the nature of things and that there needs to be some sort of organization amongst educators? What would you say to those detractors who have this view?
Well, the world is mostly hierarchical, right? I mean, so in a sense, we are kind of swimming against the tide when we question whether hierarchy is needed, and it's extremely challenging. So I'd like to make sure there's no misunderstanding. Obviously, somebody will be more of an expert in some area than others. Somebody may understand finance better or administration better, and somebody may know more math than somebody else, right? But why does that have to create a ladder system? Why do we give more importance to one than the other? Right? It's not clear to me that we need to do that, right? Because essentially in hierarchy, you have to follow what somebody says, and it's not clear to me what that following is, right? Because it's not clear that hierarchy has helped us cooperate, for example. The leaders of the world have recently met to meet climate change goals, but most people are saying we haven't really achieved anything. Yeah. So there's a clear hierarchy where we have an elected representative or somebody who's not elected who's speaking for all of us. But I don't think they have the goodwill of the earth at their heart. No. So it's not clear to me that has helped humanity in many ways. And even within organizations, it's not clear that, I mean, if you're interested in making money and it's a profit, then maybe that's the best way to organize things. I'm not sure. But For learning, for sure, I'm not clear that that's the best way to organize learning.
Thanks. My name is Stephen. I have a question. You mentioned the importance of removing fear, competition, comparison, reward and punishment from the education system. I grew up in that kind of system. And even if there were corporations sometimes, there's a kind of competition within those corporations, you know, more like, you know, competing against each other in order to win and all that. So if you're proposing that, you know, we should shift away from this mentality, what new mentality are you proposing then? Thank you.
Yeah. So, you know, one thing it's important at the outset to make sure that this is not systematically used in your school, or that's not basically your educational philosophy, that you will use fear to motivate, or you will use reward and punishment to motivate, right? But even if you remove these as systemic motivators, individuals will compare, individuals will have a sense of fear, individuals will compete, right? I mean, Abhita, being a student of our school, can share. I don't think we've eliminated fear or competition among the students between themselves. But that's why we said then you have to understand why do these things arise among human beings, right? So, but we'd like to start at a systemic level, not using them, right? You can't use fear and punishment and tell children, don't be afraid. We feel that once we've removed that, then we can investigate, why are we afraid? Why do we need to compete? Does motivation have to come from reward and punishment? Does a scientist need a Nobel Prize to do what they're doing, right? We can ask those questions because each of those have certain effects which we are not willing to address, right? I mean, I would say, for example, we are not able to cooperate about climate change because we've been trained to be competitive. We've been trained to just look after our backyard. So how will we suddenly start cooperating? Right? If from the age of when you enter school, if you've been conditioned to compete rather than cooperate, how can we suddenly start cooperating?
There's one more question here. Abhita will bring the microphone so that you will hear the question.
Yeah, sure. Thank you.
Thank you. Hello. Thank you very much for your presentation, enlightening. I have a question regarding on how feasible do you think it is to implement your ideas in our capitalist world nowadays, especially because Europe, generally the West, we suck at being cooperative, actually being cooperative as a thing. So do you think it's feasible to actually implement your ideas as a more global new understanding of learning and education, or is more as a utopic discourse? Thank you.
So can you just repeat one part? I missed one part. How useful is it to in that?
How feasible, if it's actually possible to implement it?
I think scale matters for this, in the sense that we are consciously a small school. I mean, the total size of our community is about 150. I don't think you can try to have a school with 1,000 children and then try to do what we're trying to do. So I think the scale has to be small. People have to know each other. They should know each other's names. They should be able to see each other, talk to each other. You know, CFL has now survived for 32 years. We started as a small school with 7 children on the roof of a teacher's house. What Heidi saw was the result of a lot of hard work and so on, and support from a global community. So the school actually was just in the roof of a teacher's house in the middle of the city with 7 children and more teachers than children. And then slowly we built up. So we've shown that you can educate. I don't know if we can claim our children or those who have graduated are free from all the difficulties that all human beings go through. But you can definitely educate without using all the traditional means of education, like reward and punishment. And they do well. I mean, do well in the sense they're successful learners. and they're able to earn a livelihood and relate to people and so on. So, I mean, we can show that as a small model, it's not a utopia, right? I mean, but the big challenge of cooperating, you know, completely, that's a huge challenge that we've taken on. So I don't think it's a utopia, but scale matters.
Mm. Yes, indeed. Thank you. Any more questions from the audience? No questions from online. Oh, there is a question. So the question online is that any daily practices on building our awareness of how we're listening and building the art of listening for teachers?
We don't have any practices like meditation or daily practices like that. Of course, there are some structural things like in a day, we will set aside some time where the whole community will be quiet for say 40 minutes. But, you know, one of the interesting things about Krishnamurti is he questions practice and time and so on in practicing, that you can't become a better listener over several years, right? It's an act that has to happen here and now. So I guess dialogue is the only thing that we keep reminding each other, that are we listening? Are we being attentive to the present moment and so on? So it's each person's self-awareness is what matters, I guess. So we don't have any system like that.
And I guess the smaller number of students allows also for that type of dialogue during the day practices. Yeah, that's something that I also observed. There's one more question, Shashida, from the audience.
Sure.
Yeah, thank you, Shashi, for your presentation. I want to find out, how do you assess your students? How do you, or what kind of assessment criteria do you use?
Yeah, so here too, the fact that we have a small class, so each class has only about 8 students, and we have a lot of contact with our students, right? So it's not what is called a summative assessment, right? Where you test at the end of 3 months or something. So there's a continuous interaction between students and teachers. So most teachers have a very good sense of how much their children have learned and not learned, what are the areas that they need to work on and so on. We do have assignments, that is work that they have to take away from the classroom and come back and give it to us, because we feel that they need to consolidate their learning outside the classroom space. So again, the teacher will then read what they're doing. We don't grade or we don't compare one student with the other, but we will point out the gaps that they have and so on. Yeah. So I would say it's a continuous assessment. They do take a school leaving certificate at the 10th and at the 12th grade, A-levels, just like in Finland, I understand.
Thank you. Yeah, one more question, and then we need to let Shashida continue with his work and us continue with the seminar.
Sure.
Okay, thank you for your presentation. And I want to ask, it's a so simple question, but you may have noted, but I want to ask, so what is the difference between dialogue and discussion? So you speak about dialogue, but I want to ask about the difference between discussion and dialogue. So are there any differences?
Yeah, that's a good question. Not a simple question, actually. So Bohm, the person I referred to, has done a lot of work on dialogue. Of course, these words are used interchangeably, dialogue, discussion, discourse, conversation, and so on. But interestingly, he points out that the word discussion has the same root as, concussion and percussion and so on. So the idea of a discussion is like a ping pong or a table tennis match, where there are points going from one person to the other. So often most discussions or debates are somebody trying to score a point over the other, right? And ultimately wanting to convince the other person about your point of view, right? So even for a moment, if you listen to the person and agree, ultimately it's to convince them that you are right and you'd like them to see things the way you would like to see them. So Bohm suggests that, you know, that's limited in the sense you keep, it's somebody trying to win a point, or whereas in a dialogue, you know, there are no, I mean, both parties are winners in some sense. Both parties are trying to achieve shared meaning rather than trying to prove a point or dominate the session and so on, right?
Thank you. There's actually one more question, and since we want this seminar to be participatory, so I did want to allow also the
audience. Hello, Shashi. I'm Lovis from India. I've been associated with Eklavya Foundation in Bhopal, and so quite acquainted with all the books from CFL as well. So as we know that Krishnamurti is one of those alternative schools, and we have several other alternative schools like Purna, Tunnel in Kerala as well. So you know, in India, I myself being associated with a non-governmental organization, so we are working for the, in a way, we see that, you know, how public school system can be strengthened in a way. But on the other hand, when I see alternative schools which work with a philosophy and which completely differs from the traditional way of teaching, so I keep thinking, you know, we do need alternative schools as well, because they sort of set up being a model, a kind of a role model, kind of they set an example. So how do you see this in the coming years? Or how do you see the future of probably alternative schools? You know, how do you see it, at least in the Indian context? Yeah, that's what I just wanted to.
Bit of a tough question, because I don't know if the political climate is going to allow for such spaces. There seems to be more and more view for a kind of a monolithic way of looking at things and more authoritarian way. So I think, you know, schools can be subversive spaces in some sense, right? Because school can be the place where society regenerates. So one of the difficulties of taking our model is that we are questioning everything, right? Questioning, because we're saying, let's start without beliefs, let's start without assumptions. And I don't know if an authoritarian structure likes that. So, but it would be great if we had public schools like in Finland, where everybody had free education, everybody had an obligation to learn, and you know, everybody had access to good education. I mean, it's amazing that a country can do that. So that would be fantastic if it happened in India, that everybody had quality education. But I think, like I said, our intention of education is not just to make children have the ability to have a livelihood, but to see if we can be, you know, human beings who function from a sense of cooperation and compassion rather than from self-centeredness. So that's a different challenge that we've taken on.
Thank you so much. I think it's very good to end with this, because this is also kind of part of this seminar, that we are impacted by all kinds of neoliberal capitalistic politics, as educators, as human beings, as citizens of different countries and different parts of the world. And then at the same time, we are educators who are kind of also, we have the kind of the keys to make the change. And I think that's also one of the questions that we have for our learning cafe later today, that, you know, how are we going to move forward? What is something that we can take away from this seminar? And also, how are we going to, what's the change that we will start to do in our own life, and also working, I mean, being educators or policymakers, kind of in a role that we have, the important role that we have also in this change, whether it is in regards to climate change or overall making this world more just in terms of the different sectors of sustainability. But we thank you, Shashida, very much for your talk this morning, and we hope to continue collaboration with you. Thank you.
Thank you so much. It was a privilege.
Greetings to teachers and students.
Thank you.
Thank you. And we continue with our...
May I have your permission to leave the meeting?
Yes, no hierarchical decision. Everything is based on your own motivation.
Thank you.
Thank you. Very grateful that you were here with us this morning.
Yeah, it was very enjoyable. Thank you so much.
Thank you. You can wave. Bye.
Bye.